closer.
Hi, everybody. It's Todd Conklin, and this is the Pre-Accident Podcast. Oh, it's so good to be here. I am just coming off a mammoth travel. Got in last night at 1:30 a.m., which is icky. It shouldn't have been a mammoth trip, and I'm kind of in between a bunch of trips right now. But United Airlines and I sometimes don't see each other eye to eye around the topic of scheduling. And in this case, that was one of those because crud. Every stinking flight I was on was tardy. Some of them so tardy that I missed the next flight I was supposed to be on. For those of you listening to this podcast who don't have to connect a lot of time, I'm talking to you guys in Houston and Atlanta and Chicago and places like that. Well, for those of us who live in the real world where the real people live, you got to connect on a bunch of little tiny planes to get on a big plane. And that system is so stinking brittle that if anything happens anywhere, we're pretty much screwed right where we stand. If you ever want a great example of a non-resilient, non-robust, non-reliable system, the aviation, the hub and spoke system we use in the United States is crazy. But it's not crazy when it works well. It's only crazy when there's any type of variability at all. Those of you that manage organizations, pay attention to what I'm saying, because the times you spend sitting in an airport where no one is telling you anything, which is the problem with this whole story, that is how workers feel when you're in a system that's so brittle that one piece of variability screws everything up. So there you go. There's your lesson for today. Today's podcast is a great one. Hey, thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing, and tell people, put it on your Facebook or My Face or web page or link it. I don't care. The more people that listen, the better it is, because now we're into this with both feet. I bought microphones. I had to buy a mixer. Oh, my goodness, you guys and your critical judgment on sound quality. Holy buckets. It's like I'm talking to a room full of sound engineers, or worse yet, engineers. Today's podcast features, I think, someone that if you don't know, you should know. And the reason I say that is I think this person is maybe the first applied user of Reason, Hallnagel, Decker, Conklin, name it. Anybody you want to blab out, you can name right in this little space. There's the space, name it. This is Tony Muschera. And Tony is remarkable. Now, I forgot to ask him his background, and I think because we were talking about weather and grandkids and all sorts of interesting stuff, that's why I made that mistake. Here's what I'll tell you. Tony comes out of Nuke Power, and he worked for years at IMPO, the Institute for Nuclear Power Operations. And Tony was the human performance guy, the author of many documents, an early thinker about human performance, high reliability from the sharp end of the stick, and amazing. I mean, he's amazing. If you've not met him, this conversation is actually a really pretty good conversation because you're going to get to know him a little bit for sure. You ought to take the time to meet him. He is really thoughtful and really brilliant. And I think what I appreciate most is that he really thinks about these theories from the working end of the stick, which is exactly where most of us on this podcast are probably living. Not that the academic stuff and the theoretic stuff is bad. It's not. It's vital. In fact, it's exciting and my personal favorite. But at some point, somebody has to take this information and apply it to the workplace. How do I use these ideas? What do I need to go do? What's better? What's different? What changes? Now, Tony and I have a nice conversation, and we'll have many more. I can kind of feel that. You're going to hear more from Martha because you're asking for it. You're going to hear more from James Barker because he's amazing, and I knew you would love that podcast. And you're going to hear more from Tony and probably other people as well. This conversation really focuses specifically on the idea of critical steps and how people look at those immediate non-recoverable processes that they do that really demand the highest level of performance formality and performance safety, performance reliability. And to me, what's so vital about this conversation is the way Tony has thought about critical steps and the way he's thought about sort of risk-based management. And that conversation is a great conversation for you to join in. Listen carefully, talk back to the radio, talk back to your car speaker, talk back to your computer in your office. But even better, get some managers to listen to what Tony has to say, because he's going to use some words that you may not think an applied guy is going to use. He's going to use words like mindfulness. Now, from an applied standpoint, that doesn't seem very procedural. How do you write procedural steps that say, now become mindful? Well, that's what Tony's going to talk about, and that's a big part of this conversation. So my invitation to you today is to sit back and listen with a sharp ear and really chew on what Tony has to say around the notion of identifying the places in your workplace where harm is most likely and least recoverable, because that is, in essence, the Mashara worldview. You're going to love this. I can't even wait for you to hear it. So probably what I need to do is shut up and invite you to enjoy Tony Mashara.
Yeah.
I didn't know you could change culture in 6 hours.
Yeah.
If I knew that, I'd be changing cultures all over the place.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. So, I talk about risk-based thinking to my clients, and I say, well, you know, it'll take you 2, 3, 4 years, you know, for this to really take hold.
I really,
my experience.
I really like that title, risk-based thinking. Tell me more about that.
Well, risk-based thinking really is it's an adaptation. It's not a whole lot of an adaptation from Eric Olnagel's work in the Resilience Engineering books. He talks about anticipate. It's got four elements. He calls them cornerstones. And these cornerstones are those behavior aspects of resilient organizations that allow them to be resilient, allow them to be high reliability. The first one is anticipate. You know what to expect when you do a particular job or activity. The second one is monitor. Monitor means to know what to pay attention to. What are the key parameters? Perhaps what are the critical steps that we're going to talk about? And then next is the respond. You know, these organizations respond or know what they need to do in order to maintain positive control or to control a situation such that they can remain reliable as they perform high-risk operations or react to a disturbance that they're experiencing. And the last one, even though it's last, it's not the least, I think it's one of the most important features or cornerstones of risk-based thinking is learning. It's applying what has happened in the past to our current situation. So know what has happened. And then secondly, know what is happening. That's a situation awareness perspective. And then know what to change going forward in the future. So learning has got three parts, you know, past, present, and future perspectives to it. So what I've done is basically applied the idea of thinking to these cornerstones that Eric Olnagel has identified in his research that are important to resilient organization. Because in each case, you have to know something, and that requires thinking. And
right.
Instead of using cornerstones of resilience engineering, I said, well, why don't we just call it what it is? It's risk-based thinking.
Wow. So by the time this plays, the people would have already heard it because it comes out in a couple of weeks. But I interviewed this chaos theorist in Nova Scotia, a guy named James Barker. He's someone you should meet, and he talks about, and he's also really familiar with Olnagel and also really likes Olnagel. He talks a lot about that idea of thinking as not something you would ever measure as a state. Like, there's not a point of thinking, you know, like you can't say, oh, you're now thinking at level 4. He says that you have to then understand the process of thinking in motion. So you look at movement. So are you moving forward to add value, or are you moving backwards to remove value? And that idea, which is so simple, but it was brilliant. When you hear it, it's remarkable how you use those same ideas. And then instead of measuring sort of resilience or reliability or safety as an outcome to be achieved, you actually constantly measure the motion that it's taking in the organization. And that's really helped me think differently about what we do. It's been really cool.
Well, this idea of critical steps sounds like it might be similar, because the whole idea of critical steps is to create some efficiency around where is the risk in your operation. Because whenever people go out to do work, they have a clear perspective of what they're trying to accomplish. And that's important in human reliability technology folks, you know, ISPI, International Society for Performance Improvement. And so the idea of accomplishment means we got to add value. Whenever you add value, that means we got to touch something. And whenever you touch something, you're usually going to change the state of that object or change the state of that asset to something more valuable. And the idea here is you have to actually transfer energy, or you've got to move mass from one place to another place, you know, solids, liquids, or gases, or you actually transmit information in a way that adds value. But if you don't maintain control, such as human error is a loss of control, well, then you're going to extract value. And so comparing the potential for harm is a way to identify what absolutely has to go right.
So
does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally does. When you think about this notion of error, human error, do you think error is something to be eradicated or to be managed?
Yeah, there's no way you can eliminate human error. It's part of the human condition. You know, James Reason says that human fallibility is part of the human condition. And wherever human beings are, there's human error. So, you know, one study says out of Australia said that people, when they're awake, make on order of 50 errors per day. And if you do the do the arithmetic, that equates to about 3 to 4 errors per hour in society in general. And so that you can't manage, you can't eliminate that, but you can manage the touch points. You can manage those interactions that people perform during a workday that absolutely have to go right. And that's where this idea of critical steps comes from.
So define critical steps for us, because we've got all of a sudden there's several thousand people that listen to this podcast, which I might add kind of shocks me, but it's nice. I mean, I'm glad to know so many people are thinking about these conversations. When, uh-huh. When you say critical step, what do you mean?
Okay, a critical step in an operation is a human action that will trigger immediate, irreversible, intolerable harm to some asset, an asset being something that's important to your organization, if, and this is the condition, if that action or a preceding action is done improperly. Now, can I give you an example?
Absolutely.
All right. The one I use in my with my folks, my clients is here. You are. You're in a plane, and you've got a parachute strapped onto your back, and the door is open. You're up around 12,000 feet, and I ask them, "Where's the point of no return?" And everybody agrees it's jumping out the door. All right. It's too late once you're past the door and you're free falling. It's too late to realize, hey, I wonder if the parachute was folded correctly.
That does seem like it's non-recoverable. Yes, I agree with you.
Yeah, I often ask that. I usually introduce this idea to them. I usually ask them, do you need a parachute to skydive? And so that generates some dialogue as to whether or not it's really absolute. Most people say, well, if you want to live, yeah, you need. But if you really boil it down, you don't need a parachute to skydive. You only need it to skydive twice.
I love it.
Right. And so this idea of critical step is that leap across the threshold of that open door of the aircraft while it's at 12, flying at 12,000 feet. And so what has to be true? You know, we talk about what I call risk important actions. These are the actions that you have to take to make sure that when you get to the critical step, that you can do it safely. And so right before you jump out of the aircraft, you want to verify, yeah, it's folded correctly, and I've got the harness on, and the harness is secure properly. And by the way, I have the knowledge. I know how to deploy not only the main chute, but if I had to, I could deploy the emergency chute. And so these are conditions that have to be satisfied just prior to leaping across that threshold, which I refer to as the critical step.
I like that. I like that a lot. Yeah. And I like the difference between risk important actions. I mean, the difference is recoverability, but yes. I think recoverability is everything for these guys.
Yeah. You know, the distinctions between a critical step and the risk important actions. One is risk important actions are reversible. All right. As long as I'm still in the plane, I can put the parachute on, then I can take it off. I can put it on, I can take it off. Nothing happens. I can fold it, you know, pack the parachute, and I can unpack the parachute. As long as I'm still in the plane, nothing bad happens. All right. And so risk important actions are reversible, but they also precede the critical step. So one of the things I do with my clients is we go through and I map out their critical steps and their processes. And once we identify a critical step, we stop there and then go backwards and ask ourselves what absolutely has to be true for us to perform this critical step safely. So we go back upstream into the activity and identify all those actions that create these safe conditions just prior to the critical step.
Now, that idea of identifying all the critical steps is really appealing because, well, a couple of reasons. One is I think it allows you to do something and build defenses, put in safeguards, mm-hmm. engineer controls. It also, I think, is really emotionally significant, maybe emotionally satisfying because it feels like you're catching all the problems. What about, is it possible to drift into a critical step?
Well, when you say drift, that means not aware that you're actually performing one.
Yeah. The example I was thinking of is, let's say you're cleaning out the bottom of a smeltering furnace. So it's a big hot furnace. And at the bottom, there's always a series of chutes and they fill up with basically ash. Uh-huh. And if the humidity's high, that ash gets as hard as concrete. In fact, I think ash is kind of a part of the recipe of concrete. Uh-huh. And so they have to go in there with these poles and break it out. And they never know when they're going to do the second to the last hit. Because the last hit is when it all gives way and shoots down the chute. You know, it comes falling on top of them. What about that kind of critical step?
Yeah. One of the things that I talk about with my clients is this idea of landmines. You know, in a military sense, a landmine in the battlefield is a device that's hidden where the soldier would actually walk through, and if they inadvertently step on the landmine, it releases a lot of energy and usually maims people, kills people, and causes a lot of damage and harm. Well, the same kind of situations like you just described exist in most operational environments, such that there might be a situation where there's some pressure left in a tank and a fellow's got to replace the sight glass and he starts to take apart that sight glass, or someone starts to remove a manhole cover on a tank with a residual pressure in it and they don't know it. And in a way, that's a hidden critical step that exists in the workplace. So one of the things I encourage organizations to adopt and to encourage is this idea of a chronic uneasiness. You've heard of that.
Oh, absolutely.
The HRO community talks about it a lot. But the realization that I'm trying to get people to understand is there are situations in the workplace where there can be a sudden release of energy, transfer of energy, or it could be a movement of mass or even a transmission of information that you're unaware of and can happen at a moment's note without a moment's notice and cause serious harm. So that chronic uneasiness makes them wary of these sources of harm in their workplace. Also, this idea of chronic uneasiness enhances their sensitivity to not only landmines, but also to their own potential to make mistakes.
What can a safety manager do now? Well, there's two things. One is, can they contact you and hire you to come help them do that? And then remind me to ask you that again so we talk about that.
Sure.
And two, what can a safety manager do to sort of start identifying these critical steps? And before you answer that, I feel like I should say it's really important to understand what a critical step is, because not everything is a critical step. These safety important steps are different and require different preparations and different mitigations, right?
Exactly. That's been the most important step in applying this concept, is being clear on the definition. Notice when you ask me the definition, it's a human action that will. It's not a may or probably will. It is a certainty.
That's good to know.
You don't want the frontline personnel, your frontline workers, trying to guess what's a critical step. You want them to know that if they push this button, someone's going to get hurt. It's a certainty. And so I use the word will to reflect that perspective, and it's irreversible. All right. You can't undo it. There's no undo. It's immediate. Usually when I say immediate, that means it happens faster than people can physically react to avoid the harm. I mean, it's like pulling a trigger on a handgun. Once you pull that trigger, you can't undo it. You can't put a bullet back in the chamber. All right. And that's that idea of immediate and irreversible and intolerable. You have to define, every organization has to define what is intolerable harm for their assets. All right. I always define events or incidents as harm to an asset due to an uncontrolled transfer of energy, movement of mass, or transmission of information. And that's key, that they understand what we're talking about. So they have to define that for themselves. What level of harm are we going to apply this concept of critical step? You don't apply critical steps to paper cuts. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, because that would be ridiculous. And I was just thinking, I mean, the brilliance that you talk about when you talk about this, I mean, you've thought about this, and I would consider you, well, I mean, I'll make no secret about it. I think you were really one of the very first applied users of the New View and really a forefather to everybody. But what impresses me, Tony, is just how thoughtful you are around this topic, because in many ways, this topic is really safety. It's certainly, this topic is fatality and serious incident prevention.
It is.
And it's remarkable how thoughtful you are on this. I think that's it's really beautiful in a way. And that part's really great. What if you were to give advice to a safety manager, what would you say to that safety manager about this critical steps process?
Well, I would say the first thing that comes to mind, Todd, is this compliance mentality.
Yep.
So many organizations put out these rules, and you have to follow the procedures as written. You have to do this, you have to do that. And it creates an unthinking approach to the work. And what critical steps does, it's more proactive, and it allows the people at the sharp end of the organization to be thinking about what they're doing and how they could lose control of sources of energy and mass and information that could cause harm. And so I would encourage managers, especially not only safety managers, but I would include line managers in that population, to promote expertise at the sharp end. So I've had so many clients who would hire pretty intelligent people and then give them all these procedures that they have to follow. And the people are doing the work and they don't really understand what it is they're actually doing. And so I think that's a flaw in the assumptions that the procedures are going to protect you. Too many times I've seen people think that if they're following the batch record or following an SOP, that they're safe. And that's not necessarily true. This goes back to the concept of chronic uneasiness. And when I talk to my clients about chronic uneasiness, it's important that the people have the expertise to know what it is that's important to protect and those actions that are going to transfer energy or move mass, et cetera.
How do you create, short of asking a worker to be chronically uneased, how do you create chronic uneasiness?
Well, one, it's a part of it's an educational issue, but also when they realize that they work in a system, they realize that there's no such thing as routine. Every job's different. Go ahead.
Oh no, that's nice. That's really nice. That's really nice.
Yeah, the idea is that when I start, I talk to the managers in at my client locations, and I tell them that we assume that the procedures are correct and accurate and usable for every situation. We always think that the engineers can anticipate every condition that the work is going to be performed in. Same thing for the procedure writers. There's no such thing as a perfect procedure, and so when the workers realize that what they're inheriting from managers and from the system that they're working in, they realize that there are landmines out here. There are error traps out here that can trip me up. And I have to be cautious for my own protection. And so that's part of the challenge, is to help the organizations realize that they have to be mindful. I like that word, mindful of their workplace, that there's a landmine lurking around every corner.
I like that idea of mindfulness too. And I like to think of it that really it requires leadership to be mindful. And that leadership, I think, looks at the world in a quite simple fashion. And, you know, they truly believe if the worker simply did what they were supposed to do, then no bad things would happen. And I think that's a symptom of kind of non-mindfulness at the leadership level.
Yeah. And you can't be, and Todd, you can't be mindful unless you have the expertise, you have the technical knowledge that goes with the operation, the functions, the work that you're doing. And so, and along with the mindfulness, you can't adjust. You have to be able to adjust and adapt to the work situation because procedures aren't accurate, training is not always complete, et cetera. You know the rest of the story.
Work has variability. What are some pitfalls? What should these leaders be aware of? Where could they go wrong on this?
I would say one of the common pitfalls, especially at a management level, is assuming that that every job that they put out on the floor is safe. And they assume that people always know what the right thing to do is, and that's not always true. It goes back to what I said just a moment ago, that managers need to realize that procedures aren't correct in all cases. The design is not always right. There's a tendency to want to automate everything and take the operator out. I was talking to a fellow earlier who said, well, why don't we just automate everything? And I said, well, you wouldn't get on a plane with a pilot that was automated and the pilot did not know how to fly the plane.
Yeah, absolutely. You want that ability to adapt, and you want problem solving if you have problems.
That's exactly right. So I would say, big picture, if we encourage managers to target where the risk is, And allow people to control that risk, what I call critical steps. But at the same time, I'd say at the same time, the managers have to be relentless in finding where their system weaknesses lurk, where their faulty defenses exist. That's perhaps one of the biggest weaknesses I've seen in organizations, is they don't put the emphasis on learning that they need to.
Yeah. And did you hear Martha Acosta, the podcast?
Yes.
Where she talks about pain. An athlete senses pain, and when they sense that pain, they have to triage the pain and figure out what to do. I think that's a really good way to think about system weaknesses.
Yeah, but what I admonish the managers that I talk to is not to necessarily wait for pain.
Yeah, exactly.
But I like Stephen Spears' admonition. He's the one that wrote the high velocity.
Edge.
The High Velocity Edge.
Phenomenal book. That's a great book.
Yeah, he said we have to have a relentless pursuit of truth.
That's a good way to do it.
Yeah, you have to have a relentless pursuit of knowing what is the true condition of your system.
And what's great about that is that's true operationally, it's true in production, it's true for leadership. And Tony and I would tell you it's true in life, so there we go.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say managers should avoid this assumption that everything is going right until something goes wrong. Safety is what you do. It's what you do at the critical steps to protect assets from harm while you're doing the work of the organization. You can't just say that we're safe just because we haven't had any events. You know, we haven't had any recordables in the last 2 years.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's so much fun to talk to you. Now, do you have a webpage? If I know you're super busy, but if somebody wanted to contact you and talk more, maybe bring you in and have you talk to their leadership team, how do they contact you?
Well, my email address is tmashera@mashera.com, and my webpage is www.mashera.com.
Well, that's easy. That's easy peasy. Yeah. Hey, can we do this again? This would be fun.
Oh, yeah. I got a lot more to talk about, Todd.
Oh, yes. Well, let's plan on doing it again. This is great fun. I always love talking to you, Tony.
Well, the feeling's mutual.
I can't wait for us to see each other again. That's the big problem. We never get to meet any, you know, it's so rare to meet anybody.
That's right. It's been a year since the last HRO conference.
I know. And that was a fun one. I enjoyed that one immensely. And there you have it. If you say immensely three times, it brings magic power to the podcast. What'd you think? I thought that was really interesting. It's great stuff. Now, Tony's really remarkable in the fact that he really comes to the world from a pretty strong engineering background, and he's got that sort of operator mindset. So you really hear in his voice a linear understanding of a system as an asset, as an engineer would speak of it. I actually think that's super helpful to us. It really helps us translate this message to operations people and to engineering people, because they want the world to be this very predictable outcome. They want the world to be like a drawing that they can look at and understand completely. And we have to help them understand that the world's not a drawing. And Tony is an engineer who's enlightened, at least around the notion that work is oftentimes discovered and very rarely planned. Even though planning's important, plans can't plan for the unexpected. And we're going to talk about that very topic on the next little quick safety leadership minute, the safety moment that we have. I hope you're enjoying all these podcasts. Give me some feedback if you get a chance. I'm quite available and always open. And if you're interested in being on one, or if you have something important to say, although that doesn't seem to be a requirement for me, I would welcome you. It's a great way to do it. And we can have this conversation and continue this conversation. I hope you enjoyed this. I think you're really going to enjoy what's coming down the pike. Many special guests are lining up. I'm off to travel again. I'm going to leave from here and go to Belgium. I'm going to have some waffles, and I'm going to Brussels, where clearly I'll have to eat sprouts. Then I'll head from there and go to Lexington and talk to the light bulb people for General Electric for a while. And then I'm going to head over to Singapore, Bangkok, and Indonesia. I just got all a foundation set of slides translated into Thai. In fact, I just had a twin model totally translated into Thai, which is very interesting. A little expensive, I'll tell you. They don't translate the twin model for free. But we're going to talk in that culture not so much about the power of the individual worker, because they're not really an individual culture. They're more of a collectivistic culture. So we're going to talk about the power of the organization. And it's interesting, instead of talking about preventing events, you really talk about not getting hurt. That the goal of the organization is to not get hurt, to not hurt yourself or hurt other people. And that message resonates really quite brilliantly cross-culturally. And maybe we should talk about culture. Culture's a really interesting topic for a further podcast. For those of you that work internationally, and lots of you do, you know exactly what I'm talking about, that it's hard to translate things like individual stop-work authority to a culture that really doesn't have the notion that the individual would ever have the authority to stop work. And that challenge is a big part of what goes on as well. Also, I've blabbed on long enough. It's probably time to put a close on this podcast. Thanks for your time. As always, it's a pleasure. Subscribe. Ask six people to listen. That'll help us a ton. I don't really know where we're going with this, but it seems like once we get started, we might as well see where we can end up. Lots of information. I've got a new book coming out soon, and I'll talk to you more about that as well. It's on operational learning. Until then, as always, manage a good organization, learn all the time, and be safe.